Moving on then to Module 7. Here we're going to be looking at administering Exchange Online. So I'm Anthony Stephen, here with Martin Kurtzer. And what we're going to be talking about in this module are things like personal archive policies. How do we configure archiving? How do we enable protection of data within Exchange Online? How do we do things like manage our anti-malware settings, manage our anti-spam policies, making sure that destructive and unwelcome web messages are not getting into your organization in through Exchange Online? How do we do things like configure our additional email addresses? Because typically users may have more than one email address. And then how do we do things like create our and manage our external contacts, our external mail users, resources, things like shared mailboxes and resource mailboxes and groups within Exchange Online? We've already covered this in Office 365. Let's say we're now moving on to looking at the additional features that Exchange Online provides. So in our first section then on configuring personal archive policies, we're going to talk about, I'm going to introduce you to the concept of messaging records management. And we'll then look at things like in-place archives, how do we configure attention tags and policies. We'll talk about what the process of this managed folder assistant is. This is a background process that does all that processes our mailboxes. And then we'll look at retention tags and policies. How do we apply those to how do we configure them, how do we apply them to mailboxes, and then finish off by looking at e-discovery and in-place hold. As before, Martin will be demonstrating some of these features, and we'll go through and just give you an idea of exactly how those are configured. If you want, say, the full experience, you need to come on course 20346B, which is currently undergoing revision, but will be released shortly through the learning experience channels. Right, so messaging records management. So this is one of the key benefits that the key features that Exchange Online provides, and it's about making sure that we can protect information that actually passes through Exchange Online. Now, with your own environments with an on-premise Exchange server, you may already have this sort of in place. That might be, through the records retention in Exchange server, you might have sort of third-party add-ons as well. What it does is things like it's controlling your mailbox sizes, making sure that users' mailboxes do not get too large. Having said that, they're going to struggle to get up to 50 gig, but as we know users, they will find a way to do it.
Yep.
They'll just find plenty of stuff to put in there. So what does messaging records management consist of? Well, it's things like our personal archives, you see, retention tags and policies. And again, we'll be describing all of these features as we go through. It's also this e-discovery and litigation hold, the ability to put a hold on messages that are connected with, let's say, a particular customer. It's also the journaling process, recording of all incoming and outgoing messages or recording of messages on according to a set policy. We've got data loss prevention. I say we've covered this already on the planning side in the previous module, but we're going to actually look at how we configure that. And then finally, what are the auditing features that we have within Exchange Online? So in-place archives. Now, we've talked a bit about the planning of in-place archives. And what this is, it's like a second mailbox. So when the user connects into Office 365 and connects into Outlook, what they see is a second mailbox, which is titled Archive Mailbox. And then they can simply drag and drop messages from one mailbox into this archive mailbox. Because the archive mailbox limits, I mean, it's technically unlimited, although there is a fair use policy of 100 gigabytes. Again, pretty sizable, but users, that can be extended through a support request, isn't it? Yes.
Yes. This secondary mailbox that you see in Outlook is really an extension of what users know today. It's not something different that they would experience. It's just dragging and dropping like they would drag and drop to a PSD file. But in this case, it would be drag and dropping it to an online archive, which is on the server.
I'm very glad that we're not talking about dragging and dropping to a PST file there. Okay, it's supported by all the modern clients will support that, sort of Outlook 2013, 2010, and Outlook Web Access, of course. Support with other clients, though, may be variable. So it's not supported in some of the third-party clients and some of the older clients as well. We can either enable it in PowerShell or we can enable it in through the Exchange Admin Console. And again, you depend on whether you're going to do that with multiple users or whether you can bulk enable users through Exchange Administrative Console as well. If you want to reconnect a mailbox to an existing, that's if you've disconnected an archive mailbox and you actually want to reconnect one, then that's a PowerShell only command. Use lots of different ways of moving messages, you know, just drag and drop, or you can do it through auto archive, or you can do it through email rules, or we can do it through personal retention policies, as we'll be seeing shortly.
Yep.
Right, so retention tags and policies. Now, again, I'll just sort of describe these, and then Martin's going to sort of demonstrate some of these a little bit later on. So retention tag is effectively like a label that you slap onto a message, and that label then carries out a particular action. So therefore, there are really two parts to it. There's the tag that says when it's going to happen, and then there's the action that says what's going to happen typically it's a time scale. So let's say after a year elapses, the action might be moved to the archive mailbox. And that would be an example of a personal retention tag. There are a number of different retention tags. So we've got the default policy tags, which apply to the default folders. We have folder-based retention policy tags and then personal tags, which users can then assign to their individual mailboxes. They're all linked together in a retention policy. So a retention policy is simply a container that contains one or more retention tags. And the policy applies to the users, but the users see the tags. And only one policy can apply to any user's mailbox at a time. So, and there is a default policy as well. Now, it might be that, I mean, for most organizations, that's probably going to be quite adequate, isn't it?
Yes, so depending if you have different users with different needs, you may want to build different policies. But I would assume that most customers would actually go and create one policy that suits all of their users and then, you know, keep it simple as always.
Absolutely. Okay, so retention tags and retention policies, we'll be looking at configuring those in a moment. So this is really the understanding of the aim of the policy. It's a grouping of tags that apply to that mailbox. I've pointed out that you only get one retention policy per mailbox. There is this default retention policy with a number of default retention tags, but for most organizations, or for a lot of organizations, those would be quite adequate. If they're not, the organization can define new tags, create a new policy, and apply that new policy to the mailbox. Okay, now in the background, the actual sort of service that applies these policies is the thing called the Managed Folder Assistant. So this is a data center-based process. You don't see it acting, but you can kick it off for an individual mailbox and apply that to make sure that Managed Folder Assistant runs against that mailbox. Otherwise, it's operating on a 7-day duty cycle, so it's simply just sort of ticking away in the background. And it will apply any retention tags, it will process any settings. I say there is a manual PowerShell command if you want to apply that. And then also if you're doing things like if you've configured retention hold and you want to make sure that isn't being kicked off, then you can suspend the action of the Managed Folder Assistant. Generally though, it'll simply just run in the background and you don't need to really worry about the schedule. It's only if you need to particularly kick it off against a certain mailbox and get that to run manually. So when we're applying those, I say we can apply our retention policies using Exchange Administrative Console, or you can configure them in PowerShell as well. Again, typically with PowerShell, you'd be doing that if you're doing with multiple users, but you can multi-select users and apply that way as well. So things like what you can see, if you want to see what current retention policy is applying, then use this get mailbox, put in the mailbox name, and then select retention policy, and then you'll be able to see what retention policy is currently applying to that particular mailbox. Right, well, let's have a look at some retention tags and policies then.
Okay, so I'm here in the Office 365 Admin Center, and first thing that I need to point out is this is a task that we're going to do in Exchange Online. So we need to go to the Exchange Online part of the admin portal.
And I think that's an important point to make there as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
So we go to the Exchange part of the world now. And in here, we see all the different tabs. We have a dashboard again. We have recipients where we change things on the recipients and so on. And as you could imagine, retention is managed here in the compliance part of the admin center. So over here, we have our retention policies. This is where you create retention policies or modify your retention policies. And here you have your retention tags. It comes with a couple of built-in retention policy, retention tags. Things there's a personal retention policy that says keep messages for 30 days and then automatically delete it. Just want to say keep it for a week and then delete it and so on.
Yes, because you can see there, under type, can't you? You can see, remember we talked about default policies, personal policies, and then the folder-based policies.
Yes.
So, for example, that junk email one just down there, that one there, that's a folder-based policy that applies to all messages in that particular folder, unless another policy has been applied to them.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of different policies, and we also have here at the bottom some archiving policies that says never move an item or maybe move an item after 2 years to the archive, the online archive for the user.
And you've got to notice that all the retention periods, they're not in years or months, they're all in days. So you've got to be able to convert days into years.
Yeah. Okay, so I think what we'll do is let's create one just to do some, to give you some examples. So I'm going to create one that is applied automatically to a default folder. So this is a folder retention tag. And you have to give it a name. So you can say
So this is one that if there isn't another policy, this is going to apply to the particular folder that you select there, isn't it?
Yes. So I'm going to just call my tag here, keep mailbox small. I'm going to apply it to the inbox, and I'm going to say, well, delete or allow recovery or permanently delete. That's some of the options that you have. And then you can say, delete everything after 3 days. And you say, well, this is a new manager policy that...
That must be the strictest email policy I have ever seen. So basically, what you're saying, what's going to happen there after 3 days?
So after 3 days, we're going to delete all the mail, anything that's older than 3 days in your mailbox.
That's going to make in life quite interesting. Okay.
Okay.
So now what you're going to do is create a, what, you're going to create a policy and apply that?
Yes. So I'm going to go over to the retention policies. And in here, there's a default policy. I can modify that if I want to, but... just for illustration, I'm going to create a new...
very strict policy. Or the small mailbox policy, yes. So this one is basically going to make it very difficult to keep any email at all.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to select my retention tag for keep mailbox small.
And so who are you going to apply this policy to then?
Anthony, I was thinking of applying it to you because you've been sending me a lot of mails.
That's great. I can quite have carefully managed with a small inbox there.
Okay, so we have the new policy. I'm just waiting to make sure there's no problems there. Right, so I'm going to go down to my recipients and I can go and edit Anthony's mailbox settings, and here on mailbox features, I have all the different options where I can assign policies and all sorts of other things. So I'm going to just select my policy that I just created and save that.
Right. Well, it looks like I've got my work cut out for me, or at least after 3 days, it will all be cut out for me.
Yep.
Okay, so that policy has now been applied to my inbox. Just remember on the last module, I sent you an email to Heidi.
Oh, yes.
Yes, we just wanted to make sure that was where we changed our MX record, hadn't we? Just wanted to prove that one actually came through.
Okay.
Because the first one failed, but then again, remember, it does take time for DNS records to update.
So oh, yes.
Just going into Heidi's Outlook, hopefully we should then see that the emails actually come through. Yes, yeah, so this was just going on from our previous message. And there we have, that was my email that came through from my external account. I'll say that was from my my Windows Live account. And that went after Martin changed the MX record, that email there was now being successfully delivered.
Yeah.
So it just took a few minutes to update. Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Martin.
Okay.
Right. So let's move on to talking a little bit more about eDiscovery. So this is the way of being able to search for messages across the entire organization. And that includes both not only the user's primary mailbox, but their archive mailbox as well. So what we need to do is we need to have a special discovery management role set up. This is not an IT job, by the way, discovery managers. It's really something that the legal or the HR department need to set up. So you create your discovery management role, you add your users to this discovery mail, or sorry, you create the discovery managers, you then create a discovery mailbox to which they can... which is where the discovery messages are going to be moved to, and then you can create a number of e-discovery searches, and those searches then go out and pull in the information according to the search criteria, and put those into the discovery mailbox. What you can then do is export those to a PST file, connect to that in Outlook, and then view all those messages in Outlook. You've also got the option to add in-place hold as well, and that's part of the wizard. But say, we're not going to give you a complete demo, I'm afraid. We've got a lot of things to talk about in this module. But what we're going to be looking at is how do we actually configure the e-discovery and in-place hold. Now, typically, this would be done through the discovery manager's role, but we're just going to do it through Heidi's role as well.
Yeah. So in this case, I'm still here in the Exchange Admin Center, and in the compliance and management tab. And in here, the first tab that you see is in place and discovery hold. And there was a search done previously on Heidi's, created by Heidi. I'm going to create a new in place hold wizard here. And I'm going to say this is a legal case.
Involving, let's say, Contoso. We're always seem to be having legal issues with Contoso.
Okay. And I can add some information here and so on, so that I can see what...
And of course, remember that description is important, isn't it? We've discussed this about, remember before, about handing over to other admins, and particularly because there's going to be communication here between the IT department and the legal department. You need to make sure that you've got a good description there as to what information this e-discovery search is dealing with.
And there's a note here that... in-place hold is a premium feature that you need the Exchange Online Plan 2.
So now, where we've got an E3 plan here, haven't we? Or at least an E3 trial plan. So therefore, we are covered with in-place hold.
Okay. So, and here you can specify which mailboxes do you want to actually search. So
you're probably going to be searching my mailbox again, aren't you?
Of course.
Okay, but we can search. We can add several mailboxes into that. Yeah.
So if you know that there was a specific people involved with this case, you can just search their mailboxes. But if you see that you don't know who sent a message, who did it go to, maybe you want to search the whole organization.
They're typically called the typical suspects, aren't they?
Yes.
Now, will the user know that this is going on?
So you actually can decide if you want to show the user. So in some countries, you have to tell the user that they're under investigation. So you have to show them something that it's searched.
Yes.
And other countries.
I mean, it's not necessarily suspicious. It might be the fact that all items returned in connection with a particular customer need to be put on either an in-place hold or we're going to be doing an e-discovery search against them.
Yes. So, and then we get to criteria.
Okay, well, in this one, because it's just against my one, it's picking up everything from the mailbox.
And then we can say, well, place matching search into hold it indefinitely or hold it for a specific number of days.
I mean, that might be sort of 7 years. That's quite a common sort of legal requirement. Or it might be, say, it's got to be kept forever because we just don't know.
Yeah. So I'm going to just say indefinitely because 7 years is a long time.
So what if a mailbox is on in-place hold, what happens if they actually try and delete a message?
So from a user experience, it does look like they've deleted the mail, but that mail is saved in the dumpster and they're not able to actually get to that content or delete it permanently in there. So it is protected permanently.
But the discovery manager can then get in and find that information. Yeah.
And the discovery manager, you know, sometimes you see actually people trying to hide information or destroy the evidence. And by actually deleting the mails or in sometimes they modify the emails to make them look innocent, you keep both versions of those copies and then, you know, you see the smoking gun.
Absolutely, yes. I think the paper-based memo is far better.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's your new e-discovery and hole that you've defined there. Mm-hmm. And away it goes. And that's successfully completed. Excellent.
Yeah.
Good. And there we have it. Super. Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Martin. All right. So let's move on to the next area that is the bane of many administrators' lives. And I'm sure if you've been involved with Exchange on premises, then you'll be having daily battles with the onslaught of spam and malware that seems to be increasing every year. So what we're going to look at with Exchange Online is how do we configure our malware filters. We'll look at things, talk about message headers and spam confidence levels. You know, how confident are you that something is a spam? We'll look at the connection filters, how we set those connection filters and configure those, how we configure our content filters. And there are some settings, by the way, where we can add additional policies, and there are some settings where you simply just modify the default policy here. We've also got some outbound spam settings, and then how do we manage to go about the process of managing the spam quarantine? In other words, messages that have come in and have been marked as being spam, you know, what can we do with them? Do we sort of send them on, or do we say, well, actually, that wasn't spam, or do we agree with the quarantine, the fact that they were spam, and delete them? Okay, so configuring our malware filters. Now, all of this is about integration with the Exchange Online Protection. Exchange Online Protection, I say, is Microsoft's sort of class-leading service that deals with, that sanitizes incoming messages, classifies them as spam, carries out antivirus actions, and there's multiple antivirus engines that are doing that, and then carries out particular, then you define a policy that says, right, what happens when malware is detected? And you can add additional policies or you can modify the default policy. So the default policy is that basically spam is simply deleted with no notifications, but you might, malware is deleted with no notifications, you might actually want to have a different policy for that. So when you define a malware filter, each malware filter consists of a policy and a rule. So the policy is what, indeed, in terms of detecting whether it's a, whether it's a sort of piece of malware, and then the rule is what happens to that piece of malware when it's actually been detected. With the Exchange console, you're going to be define both of them together. They're actually two parts on the same form. However, in PowerShell, what you do is you set up the policy first, and then you define a rule after that. And again, I've pointed out the default filter, no notifications, nobody's, and it just deletes the malware, and that's done with it. Okay, so I say Martin's going to be demonstrating that a little bit later, but let's have a look at and talk about message headers and spam confidence levels. Now, spam messages, and again, we've all received them. You know, eventually some of them will get through the spam filters, but it's anti-spam headers are basically about putting processing a message or processing incoming messages and then inserting this X header value, which includes a reading of what level of confidence that the system has that the message is spam. So if it says sort of, get your come to our sort of latest sale or whatever, and it's obviously a spam message, then that might have a spam confidence level of 9, which is, you know, we are absolutely certain it's spam. If they really don't know, then it might be a spam confidence level of 5, and if we're pretty sure it isn't spam, then it'll be like a 1 or a 0, and it'll be a 0 if it's typically from a trusted sending domain. So that information, that spam confidence level, goes into the message header, and then that's forwarded to the mailbox, and then depending on that header, the message might, for example, end up in the junk email box, or it might end up in the inbox. Okay, so those actions, say, all depend on that spam confidence level rating. Other connections then we've got connection filters. This is about allowing and block lists for spam-based IP address and IP address ranges. So with a connection filter, what you can do is say, right, I'm going to allow certain IP addresses to present to deliver to me, or I'm going to block other IP address ranges as well. And in fact, actually, let's move across to you, because I think probably best if we've talked about some features there. If you want to sort of demonstrate a couple of these.
So still in the Exchange Admin Center, and the stuff that we're talking about now is here in the Protection tab. And in here we have the malware filter that you spoke about, the connection filter. So in the connection filter is where we can change the settings for certain IP addresses that we want to block. So,
and it's really fairly sort of basic, isn't it, in terms of, but it can be very effective, because you can say, right, if you're receiving a lot of incoming malware or spam from a particular address range, and that might be, it might be a particular country that's an ISP that's sending that spam, you can say, right, I'm going to simply block that whole subnet. I'm not interested in anything that comes from that subnet.
Yes, a lot of companies have actually built up those lists over the years, and they have invested a lot of time to make sure that it's there, it's something they trust. And they want to also include those features in Office 365. So if you have a list that you've built in Exchange and you want to import that list into Office 365, this is the place where you can block all of those IP
addresses. Because in Exchange 2013, this is pretty well equivalent functionality, isn't it?
Yes. So this is exactly how it would look in Exchange 2013. And here you would be able to add IP addresses that you want to allow, so those will be.
Just want to sort of add one of those, or just put a blocking, because they're both the same, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah, so allow and block it's a similar sort of format. So, so what we're doing, we're putting a classless inter-domain routing format. So you need to know what your subnets are.
Yeah, so I'm going to just add some.
Are you doing a /24 there, a class C network, or what we traditionally called a class C network?
Yes, so I'm not sure if that belongs to anybody, but sorry okay, if I blocked
it's,
you.
It's nothing personal.
Yes, and there you go. So any IP trying to send mail from 11.11.11, that whole subnet will be
So that's dot blocked. 1 to dot 254, isn't it? It's going to be completely blocked on that subnet. Okay. There's an option there for enable safe list as well. Do you want to just take us quickly through what that does?
So the safe list is to also enable third-party sources that Microsoft have. So if people have registered these things, that it's something that you will accept, so you enable it that from those companies.
And that's maintained by Microsoft, isn't it?
It's
a list of what are accepted as being safe sender companies.
Yes, so Microsoft also builds up these lists, and they know that there's a lot of companies out there that we can trust. They have good privacy policies. They're not going to send out spam and so on. So by enabling that, you can trust Microsoft that you will not receive spam from those companies.
Okay, excellent. So again, if we save that one, so that's a modification to the default policy, wasn't it? Because we can't actually add any more policies to that.
Yeah, so the key thing to remember here is that this is Office 365. You don't have servers where you want to maybe set up specific connection filters for specific servers. Servers is something that's a concept that you don't work with.
You're not working at that level, are you?
Yes.
No, that's
you're
right.
Working with a server, so you just want to say, these are the IP addresses that I trust, or these are the IP addresses that I don't trust.
That you block, okay.
And that's it.
So show us about the malware filters then.
Okay. So, you can create a new malware filter. So I'm going to edit the one that we already created. And in here, you give it a name. Good practice to also give it a description to tell other people what you want to do.
So here we've got the settings, haven't we? Remember that was where I say, that was the policy, what it applies to.
Yes.
And then we've got the policy action what it applies to is a separate part from the actual policy.
Yeah.
Of course, in PowerShell, those are two, you set those up separately. But in here, we're doing it as one.
Yes. So here we have, you can delete the message, you can delete all the attachments and use an alternative text. You can delete the attachment and use custom text. So if you detected some, like a virus in a message, it will then add this custom text in the message. And you can then go and notify the external or internal senders.
So, I mean, you know,
and notify
typically would we want to notify external senders?
I don't think so.
No, probably not, would we? But we definitely would want to notify internal senders if they were sending. I mean, because it might be unwitting, you know, they might have absolutely no idea that they're doing that.
Yeah, and then you may want to notify administrators as well if you have somebody that is going to look after this and make sure that, you know, there's no big malware wave coming in.
Okay, so we can put in notify administrator. Probably want to notify Heidi, don't we?
Yep.
So we can put in her address there.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got some customized notification options as well, haven't we?
Yes. Yeah. So we can add some other people as well, from this person to that person, and then notify them that. So if there's maybe another security officer or somebody like that you want to notify and to tell them.
Yeah, to tell them that there's malware knocking around on the network.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And what other options we've got? So that's it on the settings,
yes.
And then who can we apply that to?
Yeah. So when this is where you set up the conditions. So if the recipient domain is this.
But that domain's not going to apply anymore, isn't it?
Yes.
We need to change that.
Yeah, so we've got a new domain here. So let's change that to the new domain.
Okay, because, of course, we imported that domain, didn't we? And we enabled it for use with Exchange Online. So this is an example of where we've got a rule which now no longer applies because actually we've changed our internal domain. So we need to go in and make that change.
Yeah.
Okay, and, of course, we can add some exceptions there, can't we?
And just to show you some of the other conditions, you can say if the recipient is, so you can apply this malware policy to a specific person or to a specific group if somebody is part of a group.
Indeed. Okay.
Okay.
And then set up exceptions.
And then exceptions. So maybe you know about that one guy that just absolutely loves his daily spam.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that he gets it, so you can add exceptions.
The daily spam, that sounds like a newsletter. Okay.
That's it.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed for showing us that. So that was the connection filter. We've had a look at our... let's look a little bit more about the spam side as well, because we've been talking about spam confidence levels. And also about our outbound spam. So we've got incoming spam settings, and we've also got outbound spam settings as well. So this is our outbound spam setting. This is an organizational level filter, and really it's applying to all our outgoing messages as well. It's just like we had with the IP-based filter. There's only one setting that we can make, but we can configure it in terms of how that's going to apply. Let's just have a look at those spam settings. In Office 365. Okay,
so in Office 365, we have the outbound spam, and we can change the default outbound spam policy here, and we can set some preferences again.
Again, the fairly sort of basic at this level, because really, with spam, you hope that most of your own users are not actually generating spam themselves.
Mm. But if you're worried that maybe a mailbox got compromised and some system out there is using that mailbox to send out spam,
Then this
is the way that you would protect yourself from that.
Indeed. Okay. So again, you can just set some notifications. Yeah. Now, let's have a look at that content filter, because that's the one that we haven't actually covered.
So in here, we have the content filter, and this is where you can actually go very granular on different settings. So,
okay, yeah, so let's have a new spam policy, shall we?
Okay, so...
Right, so what we're doing here, so basically the organization has decided that actually the default filter, they don't really want to modify the default filter, they want to apply an additional filter for spam settings.
And this is where you can go and set up what do you want to do with those actions. So the first thing is you can just add an X header, and this is something that may be useful in an application. So if somebody wants to act on a header inside of the message, you have an application that can do something with that. Or you can just prepend something in the text line. So you could have a system today that does that, that says, possible spam. in the subject line and you want to alert users.
So you could actually put a prepend a text like spam, 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 just like in the song?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then you can redirect that message. So maybe if you want to build up your own spam database, you can redirect that message to a spam mailbox. You can delete the mailbox, or you can go and quarantine the mailbox.
Okay, excellent. So we've got quite a range of options. And also, you've got one for spam and for high confidence spam as well.
Yes. So as you mentioned, with those spam confidence levels, so the high confidence, the nines, the eights.
That's the nine, yes. Well, I think nine. I think we only deal with nine in Office 365. It's nine, yep. Five, one, and zero, the levels yep. we deal with.
So, and then you can say, what do you want to do with that? So if something, you know, is really spam, there's no gray area there. Sometimes you get a newsletter. Some systems might think it's spam, but you actually subscribe to that. So that
it's a bulk email, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's a bulk email. Okay. That can go to your junk mail and you can go and change it.
Well, let's have a look at some of those advanced options for dealing with spam, because I know that there is one for bulk email as well.
Mm. So, yes, the quarantine. How long do you want to keep it? What's the X header if we chose the option to add the X header? What's the text that you want to add? And also, where do you want to direct it to?
So we can do international, so we can remove messages in particular languages.
Yes.
Which is quite useful.
So we can add these, it recognizes certain languages and so on. So
it's also Afrikaans at the top there.
Oh, yeah. So my own language. And so if you get any mail, if you know that your company will never get any mail from a specific language, then maybe if you do get it, you want to stop it. And this is the way that you would do it.
Okay, excellent. And also from particular countries as well, can't
yes.
you?
Yes. So this is also very useful if you know that there's certain countries that you don't trust, that you want to block, then you can choose that country. So I'm going to skip this. I don't want to offend anybody.
Hey. Right, good. So, and then we've got some advanced options, haven't we? So things
yes.
like numeric IP addresses and a URL, because that's a good sort of indicator of a spam message.
Yes. Image links inside of to remote sites, you can do that. You have IP addresses, URL directs to on other ports, a URL to biz and info sites.
Good. Well, you can see there's a real quite a range of
yes.
of options that we can configure there. We're going to have to move on, I say, because otherwise we'll just be covering spam messages.
Yeah.
So we need to say who it's applied to, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. And again, we could apply that to the recipient domain of our new lab domain that we've added.
Yep.
Great. Well, thank you again for that. That's fantastic. And then just quickly pop across to the quarantine. Oh, we've still got a few more options. okay, so we can save that one. So if we just pop across to the quarantine console, now we won't have any quarantine messages in there at the moment because we actually haven't received any. But there, what we're going to be seeing there is a number of messages, and then what is it we can do with them?
Yeah, so there's some of the. So if we get a message here that somebody is expecting a message, but somehow it ended up in a quarantine, we can go and release it here and send it on to the user, or we can go and permanently delete it.
We can mark it as actually, you know, as a false positive, can't
yes.
we? That information then gets fed back to Microsoft, mm-hmm. and that's then included is used for the analysis for things like safe senders list and stuff like that.
And you can make the world a better place.
Indeed, absolutely. Great. Okay, so that's where we've been talking about spam quarantine there. What we're now going to go and move on to is about how do we configure our additional email addresses for users. So typically, you know, we've had a couple of domains now, haven't we? Because we've had our Lucerne Publishing 030.onmicrosoft.com, and now we've added our lab 01069.0365ready.com. How do we want to process those additional emails, and how do we want to create, because we might actually want people to have both emails, or we might want to have additional email domains, because we've also got a mail.lucernepublishing030.onmicrosoft.com as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll look at the SMTP and the SIP addressing issues with additional email addresses. And then we'll talk briefly about the process about how do we manage email addresses where we've got DirSync in place. But more about that also in Module 10. Okay, so This is one of the areas where we've got a slight difference between Exchange Online and between Exchange on-premises, because we don't have the control of email policies that you get with Exchange on-premises. When you create a new user account, if you've just got the default email domain in place, then the .onmicrosoft.com domain, then you will get company name, email at companyname.onmicrosoft.com. But when we register our own company domain, in this case it was, the lab0365ready.com domain, then that additional domain, we also want to have users to be able to, people to be able to send email to at that lab.0365ready.com domain as well. Okay, and again, we might have say, fabricam.com or litware.com or another domain that's been added into that company's tenant account, and we might want to create email addresses for those users as well. We can do things like mark an email address as a primary, either through the console or through PowerShell. In fact, do you want to, Chris, quickly show us what we mean by creating these additional email addresses?
Sure.
So if we're going to go and have a look at, let's say my mailbox again.
Okay. So we're in the Exchange Admin Center, and in here we have all our mailboxes, and here's your mailbox. Now, when we changed the domain purpose yesterday, earlier in our previous module, we said that we want to use this new domain that we created for Exchange Online, which then made all the primary email addresses for those users, the lab@0365ready.com. So if we want to now maybe add another email address to your mailbox in the system, we can go to, we can open up your user, go to email addresses and add another email address in there. So we can say it's an SMTP address and...
But it's going to have to be a domain that's currently registered with Office 365, isn't it? So we've still got the Lucerne Publishing 030 domain. So I can have an additional email address with that format, can't I?
Yes.
Or I could have like Stephen@thelab0365ready.com.
So, sometimes people make mistakes with your surname, so you want to maybe just give them a short form of your email address. So, if you
Give me Stephen then, and we'll do it at the lab 01069.
Okay. I'm going to just...
You're going to cheat there, aren't you?
Do a copy, paste.
Okay.
Okay.
And, okay, so there we can see I've got my SMTP address. So how do I tell that that's which one's my primary?
So the one that is in capital letters is your primary address, and the one that is in lowercase...
And how would you change that for me then?
So I can just go in here and I can edit that. And I can make this the primary.
The reply to. Okay, so when I send out an email, my reply to address will be set to my Stephen@lab0365ready.com address.
And then you see that the one that it's been changed to the primary one is now in capital letters.
Okay, and we can do this in PowerShell as well, can't we?
Yes, so in PowerShell, there is another way of making sure that you can document it and you have a way of doing it with bulk users.
Indeed. Okay, so I've got a list of... Now, there's a slight concern with the... Well, not a slight concern, but there's a slight difference with this PowerShell command. So the PowerShell command, it's not just a single line of code, is it?
So, you have to, with the PowerShell stuff, you have to create the user, or you have to get the user, and then you have to...
Well, you get the mailbox, don't you?
You get the mailbox, and then you have to go and update the mailbox mailbox properties for the users on those email addresses.
Adding a new alias, yeah. So it's not just one, just one line of code there, is it?
Yeah.
And also, of course, we need to connect to our Exchange Online service as well.
Yes, so you have to use remote PowerShell to connect to the Exchange Online system and use those commands.
But that's rather similar to, in some ways, similar to connecting to an Exchange on-premises with PowerShell,
yes,
isn't it?
So if you've, anybody that used exchange on-premises and use remote PowerShell to connect to the local exchange server. They use the same method.
Same, yeah, absolutely. Excellent. Okay, so we can configure additional email addresses as a bulk process, and we've seen how we can do that, and say PowerShell, and you can do that in the admin console as well. Again, that needs to be planned out. When you're actually adding the domain into Office 365, then you need to think, right, are we going to be changing SMTP addresses as well, and what's the effect that adding that domain will have on our Exchange Online addressing arrangements. Great. Now, SIP addressing. Now, that was actually in the same user interface that we saw there. So the SIP addresses, Session Initiation Protocol, that's the one that applies to our to Link Online. And again, you would need to register the domain for the Link Online purpose. And then you'll have a SIP domain available for that domain. And you can have additional SIP addressing as well. There is one particular sort of scenario which we're not really covering within this course. There is a hybrid link now arrangements. If you've got Link 2013 on premises, you can actually configure a hybrid arrangement with ADFS, whereby the users, both the on-premises users and the Link Online users, can share one SIP domain. But I say it is a little bit beyond the scope of our course here, but that is one option that's available as well. But again, you can configure additional SIP domains through the console, and again through PowerShell if you need to do that. Okay, so if we've got dirsync in place, then I know we're going to cover dirsync. You know, we're going to be covering dirsync in a little bit more detail later on. What we need to do is because the email addresses are populated in Active Directory, and then the dirsync process is going to push those out into push those attributes out into Exchange Online. So we need to make sure that they're correctly configured in Active Directory, and then they come across, then they'll be pushed across into the Exchange, sorry, Office 365 environment. Okay, so you can do that. You do that through this proxy email address format. You just make sure that the primary is you put SMTP in capitals, and then any secondary emails will be configured with lowercase, and then those will show up in the user interface exactly as we showed you previously. Again, you do need to make sure that those SMTP domains have to be registered within Office 365. You must have registered that as an Exchange Online domain to be able to do the dirsync of those email addresses across into Office 365.
Yeah.
Right, so contacts, resources, and groups then. What we're going to be looking at here is the process of configuring our mail contacts and how we do a bulk import of those, how you can hide them from address lists, configuring our mail users, which is another category, isn't it, of user type, and then we'll talk about our resource mailboxes, how you can change them from one to another, and then finish off with some configuring some distribution and security groups. And I think you've got a few more things to show us on how that's done.
Yeah.
Good. Right. Well, let's talk about mail contacts then. So a mail contact in Office 365, that's just like, it's like a contact, isn't it, Active Directory? Yeah. So just like a contact in Active Directory, a mail contact in Office 365 is simply a person with an email address, and that email address is always external to the organization. The mail contact, though, cannot log on to Office 365. They have no log-on rights. So how might we use a mail contact then?
So if you know that you're working with a specific partner company and you want to add a lot of those users into your address book and make it available for people to use and pick from the global address book, then they can just see it there and select it and send it to those users. So it's a really convenient feature to your user.
So instead of having contacts in your own contacts folder, mm-hmm. basically they're contacts that are in the global address list because they're available for everyone. Mm. Okay, so those are GAL contacts, if you like. Mm. Okay, good. But we can. There are some other settings. There are a few other settings we can configure as well, can't we, with those?
Yeah. So you can actually create a lot of things with these users. You can maybe.
Why don't you just show us what we're
okay. So in here we have you set up as a contact. You have you know, you can set up first name, you can set up all the usual contacts.
That might be a bit confusing, isn't it? Because I'm actually in the GAL as well. So how might we distinguish, make it easy for people to identify if which email address this is?
Yeah, so I would definitely recommend that you add something in the display name to say this is a...
So that might be my external address. Okay, so I could have almost like a personal email in there as well if people needed to contact me out of hours or something like that, or contact me on my Play device.
Yeah. And then we have all the other contact settings and so on. And then, some of the other things that you can do...
Am I working for Heidi now, am I?
Yeah, we had to assign you to somebody. We can also set up mail tips. So if somebody sends a mail to you, this tip will come up and it will say, you know, this is an external person, or you wait, we're not going to get a reply.
So that's going to appear in when you actually try and send a message to them in Outlook or in Outlook Web Access or something like that. Excellent, good.
Okay. And then once I created the contact, I can also add the contact to a distribution list. And then when somebody mails that distribution list, you will get an email as well.
Okay. So what if we wanted, let's say, a distribution list, but we didn't really want to see all the contacts who were in the distribution list? We didn't want them appearing in the GAL separately.
So, and in that case, we need to go to groups, and we need to hide the membership for those groups. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Right. Great. So we've got lots of sort of different options for sort of managing users as well. So when we set up the contact, then we've got certain basic settings that we can make, and then we can go in and edit the contact and provide more information. Okay, right. So, but if I've got loads and loads of contacts, then, you know, doing it one by one seems like it's going to be a little bit painful.
Yes. If you're going to do loads and loads of them, it's probably better to just create a CSV file and go back to your friend PowerShell and bulk import all of them.
So that's just like bulk importing users, isn't it?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. So we've got a bulk import process then with a CSV file, and would simply use PowerShell to drag all those contacts in. Got to make sure if you're doing that we've got our first name, last name, name and external address fields present. And there are additional fields that you can put in there. I believe there are some samples of CSV files available from the support resources to give you an idea of what you can configure in those. And then you simply just run this import CSV command and create those as contacts. And of course, if you've got any updates, you know, if everyone's moved to a new department or something like that, you can simply rerun a CSV with those users and with their imported their change details, and import that again. Great. Okay. So contacts, I'm quite happy about. But we have got an option again for hiding. There's another way of hiding contacts, which we can do in PowerShell. Mm. So this isn't the one that wasn't available in the UI, isn't it? Yeah. So if you want to, if Martin said about how you can hide contacts from and make them not appear in a distribution list, but this because you hide the membership, what if we don't want the contacts themselves to appear in the GAL at all, but we actually want to be able to add them to a distribution list? And the way that we can do that is with PowerShell, and you can do this hide all contacts process. Now, if you've got dirsync, of course, that information is going to come across from Active Directory. So that's why we need to use this MX Exchange hide from address list, set that to true, and then the contact won't appear in it won't appear in the on-premises GAL, and it won't appear in the Office 365 GAL, but you can still add them to distribution lists. Okay, and again, we've got a PowerShell script or commandlet if you want to find out if somebody's hidden from the address list. Right, so mail users then. So we've talked about ordinary users in Office 365, and we've talked about mail contacts. So we've got another one, haven't we? This is the mail user. So a mail user is a bit like a contact, and it's a bit like a user. So they're like a contact in that they have an external email address, but they're like a user in the fact that they could log on to Office 365. So what could they then do?
Well, so they could then use some of the other services. So they could be a SharePoint user that's got access to a SharePoint site where they can upload documents, or they may be a Link user, but they don't have a mailbox. So their mailbox is with another system. So you just create a pointer to that other mailbox.
So they don't need to be licensed for a mailbox?
Yes.
So they don't need an Exchange Online license, but they might need a license for the other services they can use, and they can still log on to Office 365.
Yeah.
So that was like a... that's a mail-enabled contact in Active Directory, isn't it?
Well, a mail-enabled user, so it's the same concept.
Sorry, mail-enabled user, yes, indeed.
Yes.
Sorry,
yes.
Okay, so in Office 365, just like we have in Active Directory, where we've got mailbox-enabled users in Active Directory, again, we have mailbox-enabled users in Office 365. Where we have a mail-enabled user in Active Directory, we have a mail-enabled user in Office 365. And again, where we have contacts in Active Directory, we have contacts in Office 365. Mm. And of course, we can include those people in the organizational arrangements, can't we? We can set a manager, so if it's a contractor or something working for us, that contractor can have a manager.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, if you'd like to say, show me creating a new mail user.
So for creating mail users, we also go into the contact side, and then there's a little drop down here that you can specify and you want to create a mail user. And then in here, you're going to specify all the settings for those mail users.
Are you going to add yourself? Have you?
Yeah, I've been absent so far. So.
Yeah, I see it's got the middle initials. You see, in England, we don't not to bother with middle initials.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're putting in an alias as well. Again, that needs to be unique within the new mail user environment. And which external email address are you going to use? Okay. So you're putting in a Hotmail email address there. Again,
yep.
But it's external to the organization.
Yep.
What about your user ID then?
So now I need to create a user ID that I'm going to use to potentially log in with.
Okay.
And I can then...
And you can select the domain, can't you, as to...
Yeah.
Because you've
There's all our different other domains that we registered, and since we have this one registered and everybody else is using
it. It makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Use it.
But that's not your email address. That's
yes.
Yeah, that's like your UPN, effectively, in Active Directory. Okay, so again, we've got our confirm and new password and confirm password fields. And so that didn't seem like there was an awful amount of detail you're putting in there.
Yeah, so... if I want to go and update some of these things, like assigning it to a manager, or if I want to go and add it to the group, I need to go to that group and change it.
Okay, well, that's interesting. That error there, that's often you can... Because you see the items, you're saying the items you're trying there can't be found. What do we do? Quick refresh there?
Yep.
So and there bingo, was a bit of a and delay. Hopefully, and now if you go and edit the details... Yeah, so you may occasionally see that error. It's simply a timing issue, the fact that it just hasn't been updated at the Azure end.
So now I can add all sorts of other details as well.
Well, that's a lot better. So you're working for Heidi, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you can go in there and select a manager. Great. So we're now going to be direct reports at the same level as Heidi.
Yes.
Good, I'm glad of that. Okay, so we've got our mail users then. We can configure those. We can add them to distribution lists. They can log on to Office 365, but they don't require an Exchange Online license. Right, there is one difference, though. We can add them to a shared mailbox, can't we? Well, I haven't really covered shared mailboxes yet. So a shared mailbox, lots of users, different users can access, but mail users can also access them as well. So if you need access to make a shared mailbox available, let's say to a contractor, then that's possible with Office 365. Okay, so we've had a look at that. So shared mailboxes, yes, that was sort of the introduction to that. So a shared mailbox allows us to set up, you know, a generic email address. I mean, like sales@lucernepublishing.com or marketing at lucernepublishing.com, etc. And what we can do is use that not only for a send to address, but a send from address as well. So if you're a member of a group that can access, that has sort of full mailbox access to a shared mailbox, you can then send messages going outwards and say, select from, in the fields in your email address, select from, and select that shared mailbox name, and then so that email goes out, the recipient will see it as coming from, so let's say, sales@contoso.com rather than your personal email address. And of course, the response will go back to the shared mailbox. So anyone who has the right to connect to those shared mailboxes will be able to see that information. Right, so we've got three levels of access. We've got full access, send as, and send on behalf of. And typically you would give people send access. So you would have a send access security group, you would have a full access security group, and maybe a send on behalf of security group as well. We've got this auto mapping feature. Just be aware of if you're members of loads and loads of different groups. So basically what that will do is open all their mailboxes every time you log on to Outlook. If you've got too many of them, you might want to disable that feature for that particular mailbox. Right, so another type of mailbox type that we've got is a resource mailbox. So give us a couple of examples.
So you might have rooms in your organization that you want people to book in Outlook. So that's one way of doing rooms. Or there could be equipment. You have a projector that you need to reserve when you book a meeting room. So you want to reserve that and use it as a library system.
So that's a piece of equipment as well. So yes. It's not just a room which doesn't move, but a piece of equipment which potentially does move.
Yes.
But what if the projector's attached to the ceiling in the room? Are we going to include that as part of the room, or is that equipment?
I think we need to do that as a room.
That's part of the room, isn't it?
Yes.
So you book the room and you book all this. Everything that's bolted down in the room comes with the room, whereas if you need a separate projector, then that's a separate item of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I know that you use this a lot in Microsoft.
Yes.
So, of course, you can see on the little sort of funky panels on the doors, you know, what the current status of the room is and who's booked it.
Yeah, so all of those things are integrated using EWS, Exchange Web Services, and it allows us to query the information.
So why is it whenever I book a room, I book a room and I come across from the UK, and I come across the States, and my room bookings are never showing, you know, why is that? You know, I always seem to have booked the rooms in the midnight, you know, what's going on?
I really don't know how you're doing that. Maybe you're picking the wrong time zone or something like that.
That's it. Time zones, of course, I should have known. So it's all time zone sensitive as well. So if you've got an international company, one of the key reasons that you can end up with resources not being booked correctly is the fact that you've got the wrong time zone.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens if a resource is booked, though?
Well, so you can then you can set up how the system needs to act on those things. So you can say, well, automatically accept the message always when somebody books it, or it could be a restricted room so that.
So it could be like go to a receptionist, and the receptionist could say, yes, I'll deal with that booking. Or there could be an automatic message. It could automatically accept the meeting and then just book that resource.
Yeah.
So what happens if I try and book a resource that's already booked?
It will then decline the meeting.
Okay, excellent. Well, that makes sense. Perhaps if you also want to show that how that might happen.
Okay, so in the recipient's side of the Exchange system, we have resources here, and then we can add a resource mailbox, and we have the option here
to just set up a room. Why not?
Okay.
Okay, so we've got. But so it's going to get an email address. Wow,
yeah.
that's funky. I can email a room.
Yeah, because this is a mailbox, so it needs.
Is the room going to reply to me?
Yes, the room is going to tell you that you're welcome to come and visit it anytime.
It gives an entirely new meaning to get a room, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So we can put in things like, we can give it a phone number, can't it? Because hey, a lot of rooms have got phones in. Capacity, now that's going to be very useful, isn't it? Because we don't want to overbook on the capacity of the room.
Mm.
And also, we've got to say that, and you can see there the options for accepting or declining the booking automatically,
yep.
Or selecting who can accept or decline booking requests for that particular room. So again, Heidi's in charge of that particular room, and we can save that. Excellent. Okay, well, again, it's pretty similar for equipment as well, isn't it? So
yes.
There's no need to demo. Well, thank you. Good. That's that's useful to know. And again, we can, with the sort of further fields that we can configure on based on the room or the piece of equipment.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we can change these different mailbox types around up to a certain extent. So users you can change to resource and back again. Resources you can change to shared and back again. Shared mailboxes we can make into a user mailbox. What we can't do is make a user mailbox directly into a shared mailbox. But of course, you can take a user mailbox to make a resource mailbox and then make a resource mailbox into a shared mailbox, so ending up in the same place. So you can change these sort of mailbox types. It's like a flag in Exchange Online as to what type of mailbox, if it's either shared, a resource, or a user mailbox. Right, so distribution and security groups. I know we've touched on these briefly in Office 365. Really, I wanted to sort of highlight the differences between, this is like your compare and contrast slide. Really, just to highlight whether they're visible in Office 365, whether they're visible in Exchange Online groups, in the Exchange Online distribution security groups, whether we can set permissions with them, whether they've got email addresses, and whether they have a dynamic whether they're dynamic or whether you can self-enroll. Perhaps if you'd just like to show me sort of setting up one of those distribution and security groups.
So in the Exchange Admin Center under recipients, you have groups. And when we click on that, we have three options. So we have the distribution groups, the normal distribution groups, the security groups, and the dynamic distribution groups. So I'm going to create a distribution group.
Yeah, let's just do a distribution group, shall we?
Okay, and then in here, we're going to give it a name. So I'm going to just create one for now called sales.
Yeah, why not? Because sales always need a distribution group. Somebody's got to answer. And so it's given us an email address, hasn't it? So again, we can email the group.
Yes.
And what will happen then if the email comes into the group? It will go
to all those members.
To all the members, indeed.
Okay. And then here's the owner. So you can set up different owners. Do you want to allow to manage those groups?
Okay, excellent. So we've got some sort of management environment in there as well.
And then you can also say add all group owners as members. Then we can add specific members as well.
So, okay, great. So let's get some salespeople added in there.
Not sure if all of them are sales, but... Okay. And then you have some management options here. You can say anybody can join this group, or it's a closed group, or it needs to go to the owner before it's approved.
Okay, yes. So that's a sort of self-enroll in a group process.
Yes.
Yep.
And then you have options as when people can leave the group. So they can leave anytime they want, or only the owner can...
They can never leave. Isn't that like Hotel California?
Yeah.
Okay, right. So we'll save that group. Fantastic. So there's the other group types as well that we can do it. Just want to just highlight the difference with a dynamic distribution group.
So with a dynamic distribution group, we're going to actually set up some sort of criteria that you have to meet to be a part of that group. So for example, let's create one for marketing.
Yep, needs an alias, doesn't it?
Yep. And then we can say, well, we want only users with mailboxes, and we add a rule to say anybody with department that is equal to...
Marketing, that would be...
Marketing.
Yep. So if we add anyone, if we change anyone's department to marketing, they're automatically going to be enrolled into this group, aren't
they?
Yes.
Simple as that.
Excellent.
So...
We need to add. It's actually an add, isn't it?
Oh, did not.
So you need to click the add there. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Super. So we've set up some distribution groups and security groups. Just very like distribution groups, except they have an additional security context that we can apply. So we can apply permissions with security groups in Exchange Online.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that was quite a long module there.
Yep.
So we've covered sort of our personal archive policies there, talking about how we configure mailbox records management within Exchange Online. We've finished off where we've looked at sort of some of the options for anti-malware and anti-spam, and you can see that there's quite a lot of configuration that we can carry on in the background there. We've gone through the process of how do you add additional email addresses for users, and then finished off with creating some contact resources and groups. So that you've got an understanding of how to create groups and how to manage those in Office 365. In our next module, what we're going to do is move on to looking at SharePoint Online and talk about some of the issues with management of that in that particular interface.